Friends, we wish you all a Merry Christmas. And as it happens to be the very day of Christmas on which we are meeting, it's only appropriate that we look at the spiritual significance of this great festival. And the best way in which we can understand the spiritual or the inner significance of the festival is by understanding the allegory of Jesus' life. As H.P.B. says in one place, that the whole of New Testament, in a way, is an account of the cycle of initiation. From man being born in flesh up to his second birth and initiation. And that is what is actually allegorized in the life of Jesus. At a simple level, if you read, Christmas is considered to be a festival which is supposed to emphasize the spirit of giving. But do we really see that? What kind of giving? A great satire appears in H.P.B.'s pamphlet on Christmas, pamphlet number 23, where through a vision that she describes, which a man had, she brings this out. This is a vision that a man has of being inside the most palatial church, which is decorated, and a great Christmas mass is going on, filled to the capacity with the men and women who are dressed in the best of clothes. The pulpit is having that priest who is giving out again the sermon, ending with a prayer in the choicest words, in a good diction. And by the side of this priest is standing a recording angel from heaven who has come down expressly to write down a deed of real charity or real prayer which would become acceptable to the God. And this man is there in the congregation and he sees that the entire sermon and the service is over, but the recording angel doesn't make any note. Then the parishioners part, they go one by one outside the church, and near the wall of the church is standing one poor little girl, tattered clothes, dirty clothes, and very carefully keeping a distance, all the parishioners pass her by without giving her anything. And then just then passes a drunken sailor who happens to see her, and even in that half-dazed state, he puts his hand in the pocket, takes out a few pennies, pushes it on her hand and says, "You poor little cuss, have this." And then we are told that the recording angel, her face is lighted up with celestial radiance, and she makes a note of this deed. Now, this is what, one thing she is trying to say, H.P.B., is that what use is that great religious observance of watching, of having that mass year in and year out? At the end of that mass, did it really stir the heart of the person towards any kind of charity? All of them, they just went away. Secondly, what kind of charity are we talking about? As another Christian writer, Professor C.S. Lewis, writes, again, a very satirical essay where he says what Christmas means to me. One thing he says, Christmas seems to me to be a kind of a public holiday, which is an occasion for merrymaking. But greater than that, what overshadows everything is a commercial racket. It seems to be the occasion where days before Christmas, people go out shopping, 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 shopping for the right gift, shopping for the greeting cards. And then finally, they are so totally exhausted physically, so totally exhausted mentally, writing down the list of people to whom they are supposed to send the greeting card and the present and all that. And then just when they have settled down, there comes a parcel or a greeting card from a person they had forgotten. So off you go to the market, buying now the appropriate gift, because it has to be reciprocated, you see. So he says that this is more like a social obligation, the gifts which we give. Business obligation. Where is the pleasure in the heart of the one who is giving or in the heart of the one who receives? In fact, you compare that I gave him such a gift of such value and he or she has given me only this gift, and so on and so forth. Whereas, as compared to that, what H.P.B. says in that pamphlet on New Year, that each man and woman is endowed with almost a magnetic potentiality. When that is backed by sincere and indomitable will, then it becomes an effective magic lever in your hand for good or for evil. So let us, as theosophists, or let us, all those who want to be good Christians, let us send out with sincere will the very good wish for those whom we care for, rather than hunting for the right gift to give them, and then it will reach them. Just being sitting at home, it's in sincerity, if we say peace and goodwill to all, then we will reach all the creatures without having to send a greeting card. And this is something which we do find coming out slowly and gradually in some of these Christian writers who are totally dissatisfied and even pained at the way Christmas is being celebrated. Perhaps you are aware of the name of Jenina Gomes, whose column now and then appears in the Speaking Tree. And there the article begins, the one which appeared just yesterday. She says that, look, 2000 years ago, Jesus and his parents, they were not welcome. From inn to inn, Joseph and Mary were going, and finally what they got was a small stable in an inn where Jesus was born, in a dirty little manger. And this is exactly what even HPB brings out in that article, that before the dazzled eyes of the devotee, that poor little manger, the dirty manger, just seems to vanish. He has absolutely no idea or memory of that Jesus who said that it is so difficult, I mean, for a rich man to enter into heaven, and it would be far easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle. That Jesus, where is he? And so she says, just as then, today Jesus is as unwelcome. Where do we have space, time, energy for this Jesus? We have crowded him out, because tomorrow people will be merrymaking with their artificial lights and noise and parties and all that. Who is going to remember Jesus? But if somebody will just look into the eye of the old, the helpless, the orphan, the lonely, and sit down and meditate, they will be able to hear the voice of Jesus, or they will be able to have some glimpse of what real Jesus was like. Now, it's very heartening, coming from a very, seems to us to be a devout Christian, and corroborates what HPB herself told. Now, having seen this, it's not as if we are looking down upon the merrymaking, but why do it in such a way where not everybody is able to participate, especially the student has seen during such festivals? Why even exclude Deepavali? The rift between the haves and the have-nots becomes absolutely obvious. It just hits you in the heart and in the face, that there are, on the one hand, the haves just squandering money, and there are the have-nots who simply, as she describes in that pamphlet, they only have to be satisfied with the smell of the savories which are being cooked in the rich man's home. Why make it such a celebration, which has no meaning? Now, coming back to the whole inner significance, then, as was brought out by the first speaker, it is supposed to have been the festival which was celebrated by the pagans as the birthday of the sun god. And we are told that winter solstice, December 25th, is the time when sun begins his movement towards the northern hemisphere. We call that period as Uttarayana. So also it is said that on December 21st, the sun, as it were, is supposed to go underground, helping the seas and the imprisoned souls, and come out triumphant on December 25th. Now, what does this mean? This means something which happens actually in the mystery of initiation. In fact, if you look at the mystery of initiation of Vishwakarman, their son represents the candidate who wants to take the second birth or spiritual birth. And it is said that the wife of sun, Surya, is Sanjana, spiritual consciousness. And she is not able to withstand the beams of the sun, which actually represent a very great passion and desire. So the spiritual consciousness complains to the father, the divine carpenter, Vishwakarman, who is supposed to put this sun on the lap and cut away these rays of the sun and create a kind of darkness. And we are told that actually the candidate is made to sit in a dark cave or a crypt, inspect or look at his own lower levels of consciousness, not get disturbed, purify it, and then come out triumphantly as a purified candidate or purified God. And that is how we say that it is, in one sense, this is what is the birthday of the Son, where the candidate, the Son, goes down, purifies his levels of consciousness and comes out triumphant. In another sense, as we said, the Son begins its northward journey towards the northern hemisphere. And as HPB says, that the astral life of the earth is young and strong during this period. Now what does this mean? We are told that Sun is a giver of life, physical and metaphysical. Because behind the physical Sun is a central spiritual Sun, the seventh principle of the cosmos, the very Atman in man. And we are also told that it is this Sun who is supposed to energize the very life energy which is in the astral body and in the astral which is of the universe or the world. And all the good thoughts, ideations which we impress upon the astral life, they are going to support us. Whenever next we make any resolve or whenever next we are trying to do something good, these good impressions which are there in the astral light, they come back and support. Now, during this period between Christmas and Easter, when we say that the life energy is renewed and refreshed, it is as it were the support comes to you unobstructed. And that is why she says that whatever resolve you make, it will have added impetus from the nature's forces. Also, as we said, Sun represents that very Atman or spirit. And we are told in one of the articles by Mr. Judge, Our Sun and the True Sun, where he brings out that thing from the Gayatri Mantra, where it is said, it has been translated slightly differently from the usual, and the aspirant says, "Unveil, O Pushana, that face of the sun, which is hidden over by the golden lid." It is as it were the physical sun is hiding the true sun which is behind. And Mr. Judge explains in the article the commentary on the Gayatri by saying that this is a cry which is sent out by a person who is a sincere seeker after truth, who is wanting to go and communicate with his divine nature, but who is also aware that there is something obstructing it. And that something is his own karmic effect. Karmically, he has brought such brain, such passions and desires and personality, which is standing in the way of this union and communication with his divine nature. And therefore, as as the voice of the silence says, that how are we then going to come in touch with it? As page 19 of the voice of the silence says, that one unfading golden light of the spirit, it shoots its effulgent beams on the disciple from the very first. But to feel that light, what should we do? Unless the flesh is passive, the head cool, the soul as firm and pure as a flaming diamond, that sunlight will not reach the inner chamber. Some inward preparation needs to be made before we can partake of that guidance and help from the sun within. And again, we would refer to, in one sense, therefore, if we say that Jesus, as HPB points out, is the very Christos principle in you. The first quotation we did not read because it just gives us the suggestion as to what kind of gifts should we give. It's very interesting, but we won't read it. But in the second one, we are given that in one sense, Jesus or the Christ, he is not to be sought in the wilderness or in the inner chambers or in the sanctuary of any temple or church built by man. For Christ, the true esoteric savior, is no man, but the divine principle in every human being. He who strives to resurrect the spirit crucified in him by his own terrestrial passions and buried deep in the sepulchre of his sinful flesh, he who has the strength to roll back the stone of matter from the door of his own inner sanctuary, he has the risen Christ in him. So in one sense, it is the very Christos within that we are talking about when we talk about the sun. It is the very higher nature, the spiritual nature in man that we are trying to reach. So in order to know the real Jesus is to know this Christ. And knowing that real Jesus is not an easy thing. Mortifying the flesh, making your soul as pure and firm as flaming diamond, which is put slightly differently, by, again, Janina Gomes, when he says that Jesus, in a way, actually comes here wearing the face of God. And to understand real Jesus is something so difficult, you actually have to repeat the adventure of the life of Jesus, going through what he went through. As she says, the ultimate gift that God gave us was to show us his face in Jesus. Yet, it is the true face of Jesus that people would rather flee from. That is because the gift comes wrapped up in foils of hardship, pain, affliction, poverty, and sometimes even disgrace. We will recognize all of these things Jesus went through. The wrappers so intimidate us that we hesitate to open the gift. Really, do we really want to understand who Christ is? Go through all these things and you will know what Christ is. But as she says, the wrappers so intimidate us that we don't open and we don't try to know who the real Christ is there. Now, Christ, in a way, in fact, Jesus has many aspects. Often the question arises, and now and then you again have the debate, did he really live? What about the historical Jesus? Again, to that we have the answer, that in a way, there really was a person like Jesus, who lived 100 years before. He was the son of Joseph Pandira in the reign of some king, Alexander, we can't pronounce his surname, something. And at that time, just as in the life of Jesus we find, it was at that time that there was the king who ordered the massacre of what is called as infants, but what HPB calls as the massacre of innocents and babes, which is the persecution of the wise and the initiates. At that time, the parents are supposed to have gone to Egypt, and in Egypt, as the records also show, Jesus was educated by the Egyptian hierophants, and then he became the Essenes, but he fell out with the Essenes because of some differences in the religious observation and observances, and he became a Nazar, a Nazarios. Now what does Nazar mean? It means set apart. And we are told that in a way, if you take it as allegory, the one who is trying to get the second birth, he has to alienate himself from the herd, from the ordinary humanity, as he himself said, come ye out from among them and be ye separate. That you can't be the man of the world and walk in the ways of the world and follow it and also have the spiritual life. So come ye out of. So he becomes a Nazar, and then of course the record shows that he was also stoned and crucified and resurrection and so on and so forth. Now we find that same thing is also there in Jesus' life, that he was the son of Mary and Joseph, but we are also told something about the Immaculate Conception, that it was Virgin Mary through whom he is supposed to have taken birth. Now once again one finds that now and then people are questioning this aspect of Immaculate Conception. They are saying that does the nativity account of Jesus, is it really a fact or a fiction? Is it a mixture of history and faith? And some scholars have come to say that we can trace it to the pagan origin. That some of these accounts are copies of the pagan accounts. Second thing that we are told about Jesus' birth is that he is born at Bethlehem in a manger. Three wise men are supposed to have come following the star and then finding him, bringing with them the gift of gold, myrrh and frankincense, which of course myrrh and frankincense, we are told, they are having medicinal or healing properties so that it would protect the child. Now, regarding both these things, what does HPB say? In one sense, we have to understand that Jesus also represents the Logos. As we are told in the very first chapter of St. John's Gospel, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. So it is talking about the very Logos, and when you take it allegorically in that form, she says that the male element in the nature, it is supposed to be personified by the Logos, and as she brings it out, that it is born through and not from the Immaculate Mother. And that is how we have to understand the virgin birth. As in the transaction, she says that residing in and issuing from the Mula Prakriti is the unmanifested Logos, which is both her husband and son, and which is also the concealed father. Now, this is a bit of a metaphysics, but we bring in to show that if you don't take it that way, she says that the very grand concept of immaculate perception has been carnalized by the churches. And then there is a lot of trouble. It's a totally metaphysical concept. As regards the three wise men coming and following the star, as you know, during Buddha's birth also, certain signs were seen in the heavens when a great being is born. Similarly, at one place in the secret doctrine, we are told that Kepler is supposed to have said that at the incarnation, something was seen in the skies. In the Pisces, the constellation which is supposed to be, taking care of this zodiac sign Pisces, all the planets came in conjunction in that Pisces. Now, we don't know, but it's there in the secret doctrine. And there she says that was called by him the constellation of the Messiah. And that star of Magi, which was seen, that star is part of this constellation, which is supposed to be represented by the zodiac sign Pisces. So this is what the explanation theosophy has to offer regarding these things. Now, if we go further in Jesus' life, what do we find? That at the age of 30, he goes out, leaving his mother, and then comes to River Jordan, where John the Baptist is supposed to be baptizing people with water. And that means whoever came to him for guidance, he is giving them knowledge. But all the time he's saying that I baptize you with water, but he that is going to come, he will baptize you with fire. He will be like a farmer who thrashes out and makes separate the grain and the chaff, burning the chaff and securely keeping the grains in the jar. He will segregate the good from the bad. Now, we can see here that baptism here actually represents the process of initiation. It is the very symbol of regeneration. There is one stage at which there is some kind of regeneration takes place through knowledge. But there is another step, which is where, as Master says, chelaship is the psychic resolvent, which burns away all the dross and keeps only pure gold behind. So that step becomes necessary in one's life towards adeptship. And that is why in our reading we find that Nicodemus is supposed to have approached Jesus, and he says that how can I be saved? How can I enter the kingdom of God? And Jesus says, verily, verily, I say unto thee, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. And HPB says, this illusion, so unintelligible in itself, is explained in Satapatha Brahmana. It teaches that a man striving after spiritual perfection must have three births. First, physical, from his mortal parents. Spiritual, through religious sacrifices or initiation. And third, his final birth into the world of spirit at death. So we can see that this is what he was talking about. And in fact, he says that you will not understand all these things. The verse in the Bible is that wind bloweth where it listeth. What he's trying to say is it easy to catch the wind and pocket it or put it somewhere? Is it easy to understand the movement of the wind? You can hear the sound, but can you really follow the movement of the wind? So also, the action of the spirit, or the knowledge regarding the world of spirit and what happens there, it's not so easy to express in words. But HPB says that the real translation should be, spirit goeth where it willeth. That is to say, that it's not as if you can catch that spirit or somehow by force try and have it incarnate into you. But just prepare the soil and then it will descend into you. So this is just one of the things, by the way. But coming back to this initiation, therefore, in the esoteric character of the Gospels, in fact, it is well worth going through whatever little we understand out of it. But then HPB brings out this very important distinction. She says people should call themselves Christians and not Christians. Because Christos or Christian means one, good people. So that's all that we are, good people. And Christos also means a candidate for hierophantship, a disciple for initiation, and it is during this process of initiation when he undergoes all the trials, tribulations, tests, temptations, which we just read out, explained as hardships, pain, affliction, poverty, and disgrace that Jesus went through. When all this is gone through, then, as a kind of a mark of last ritualistic observance, his body is rubbed with oil and he is anointed. And therefore, from being Jesus, which in one place HPB says, it comes from the Hebrew word Eish, meaning man, he becomes Jesus the Christ. You get the appellation of the anointed one. Just like Gautama becomes Gautama the Buddha, Gautama the enlightened one. So also there is this Jesus, and then you become, or the and then it is that the Christian becomes Christian. The Christos becomes Christos. So this is what she explains, and that is why we are told that Jesus was not the only Son of God. Why would we be told about all these things? Unless and until we also have the potentiality of becoming what he was. That we are all sons of God in our potential, in our inner nature. And so, again, on the first page of the quotations, we would read together, which we skipped out. One is a very beautiful account what the masters think of Jesus. Even the Jesus who was the initiate and the adept. The masters say, the position they, the Mahatmas, give to Jesus, as far as we know, is that of a great pure man, reformer, who would fain have lived but who had to die for that which he regarded as the greatest birthright of man, absolute liberty of conscience. Of an adept who preached a universal religion, knowing of and having no other temple of God but man himself. That of a noble teacher of esoteric truths, which he had no time given him to explain. That of an initiate who recognized no difference save the moral one between men, who rejected caste and despised wealth, and who preferred death rather than to reveal the secrets of initiation, and who finally lived over a century before the year of our vulgar so-called Christian era. But in the next one we are told, whether the Jesus of the New Testament ever lived or not, whether he existed as an historical personage or was simply a lay figure around which the Bible allegories clustered, the Jesus of Nazareth, of Matthew and John, is the ideal for every would-be sage and Western candidate, theosophist, to follow. That such an one as he was a son of God is as undeniable as that he was neither the only son of God, nor the first one, nor even the last, who closed the series of the sons of God, or the children of divine wisdom on this earth. Now we can see that therefore that Christos principle, as we just saw, is within us. And it is very essential for people to understand that that Jesus is not really outside of you. Potentially you are all capable of becoming Christ. In our higher nature we are the very Christos. We are having that Christos in us. Now why is it so necessary? As is pointed out by HPV, that in one sense it is true. When we say his name is supposed to be also Emmanuel, and his name is also supposed to be Yesu, meaning the Savior, but in what way is he Savior? In one sense, yes, that there are these initiates and the adepts who can take upon themselves a little of the collective suffering of humanity because they identify themselves completely with humanity. But can they really take up the sins of the individual person? And this is what people are made to understand. People are made to see that Jesus died for us on the cross. So the blood that he spilled, if you believe in the blood of Christ, your sins will be washed off. And HBB says that it's very easy. All your life you can make the sins, you can murder people. Last, there is a kind of deathbed conversion. At the time of death, you confess your sin, profess your belief in the blood of Christ, and you are absolved. Your position in heaven is also assured. That man did well by murdering rather than living a good life, because the good man may or may not go to heaven, but his place is assured. So because of this, she calls this thing as the pernicious doctrine of vicarious atonement. But what is the real meaning of vicarious atonement? That she gives us in the transaction and points out that this Christos, the real nature, the higher nature, sends out a ray, which is the lower mind, and that lower mind gets all enwrapped in the worldly things, lower passions and desires, even wicked things at times. But the misdeeds of the lower, at the time of death, they again become one. And the misdeeds of the lower are fastened upon the higher. And so she says, the poor innocent Christos, who had no hand in these things, is, as it were, becomes a scapegoat. And because the karmic focus, once the personality is gone, where is the karmic focus shifted? Karmic focus is shifted back to the ego, the Christos. So it is this Christos who becomes a scapegoat and vicariously, as it were, atones for the misdeeds of the lower. That is the only thing. And as for crucifixion, she says, as our quotation points out, that every time that you turn a deaf ear to that voice of conscience, the voice of your higher nature, which is trying to lead you on the right path, at all those occasions, daily, maybe 100 times, we must be crucifying the Christ within us. In one sense, therefore, that cross symbolizes, in the mysteries of initiation, the actual tying to the cross of the disciple. And it is in a way a symbolical of the fact that you are supposed to leave on that cross, nail it, leave behind the passional, the lower, purely personal aspect and come out. Just like a butterfly breaks open the cocoon and comes out as a totally transformed being, so also are we supposed to nail those things to the cross and then come out in our spiritual, ethereal body, as it were. Now, in another sense, it's very important for us to see that cross may be also taken as our own karmic responsibility. It's a very moving sight. Every time that we see the movie, you see Jesus was made to carry the cross. The very cross on which he was nailed, he himself is carrying the cross. And we also talk about, you must carry your own cross. Now what is that? In one sense, that cross, we can say, is your own karmic responsibility. Whatever karma you have created, and because of that you have created such circumstances which are now unfavorable, whether it is the deformed body, or whether it is poverty, or whether it is bad relationships in the family, or whatever it is, that becomes your cross. And we want to, as it were, blame it onto others or get rid of that cross, but that is the cross that we are supposed to bear. And we are told in that little story that to each one, that cross, whatever is the difficulty, seems to be enormous. Maybe you are all familiar with that. It's a story of the anecdote of a man who goes to God. He is at his rope's end, whatever he was suffering in life. He goes to God and says, I can't bear this cross. And God says, give it to me. You can exchange it for some other cross. And then he is taken into the room, which is lined up with crosses of all sizes and shapes. In the beginning of the room, there are huge crosses, and he wonders, my God. Then he goes on and on and on till he comes to the end of the room, where there is a very tiny cross kept somewhere aligned to the wall. And he says, this is the cross I will have. And God says, my child, this is the cross you just brought in. And so, this shows that somehow when we see others, you feel that, okay, their difficulties are not so much, but my cross is so difficult to bear. Now, this is, in one sense, therefore, this is our own doing. And if, as someone has said in just single line, that if you shun the cross, you make it heavier. In what sense? If you shun the karmic consequences which have come, you make it heavier, actually. Because one way of making the cross lighter is to accept what comes, accept the woes of birth, as it is said. Meet them head on, the way they come, understand what they have to teach, get rid of them, liquidate those debts, and then the cross will become, as it were, lighter, rather than shunning it and making it heavier. Now, interestingly, we do see that this need is there. We won't read those quotations which are there, which can be read. Now, this need to understand the inner significance of what Jesus represents, what was his teachings, is very important. As one finds more and more Christian writers coming out and saying that, have we got Jesus wrong? As is pointed out in Harper's Magazine, which appears in one of the items of In the Light of Theosophy also, where he says that, have we got Jesus wrong? We, the Americans, are supposed to be one of the most Christian of the nations, but least so when it comes to application. Jesus told us that, who is the true Christian, the righteous man? How will you know him? He is the one who will feed the poor, who will slake the thirst of the thirsty, he will go and visit the prisoners. And today what do we find? As a great Christian nation, the America, with statistics he shows that there is so much poverty, there is so much want everywhere. We are the most violent rich nation with lots of teenage pregnancy, the divorce rate. Every now and then you see these celebrities, they are getting married and after 1 month you see they are also divorced. Now the divorce rate also is so high. And what is the church like? This is coming, by the way, from a scholar in residence, a Christian, who is saying the very things which probably even HPB would have written about. Like today you look at the mega churches, they are like palaces. You have those counters where donuts are sold and this and that and all those things. And what is there in the church? The sermon will be on how to bring up your children, or how to manage your finances, or how to manage your stress. There are scores of books, he says. And if you review some of them, in one line you can say that that is a treatise on getting God to serve the demands of a self-centered individual. God give me this and God give me that. Look at the columns also in our newspapers, spiritual columns. Sometimes we never miss to read those. And you find that most of them recommend prayers which are petitionary prayers. We are told to pray morning, evening, night, but petitionary prayers. Do this, pray for so much time, whatever is there in your heart, it will be given. Did Jesus really recommend these petitionary prayers? He said, when you pray, you do it in secret. Don't do like Pharisees and Sadducees who do it in public places. Pray to your Father in secret. And when you do it in that way, it will become a command, not a prayer, it will be a command, and it will definitely happen. But what is that prayer, he says, as HPB says in the Key to Theosophy, where you ask not for any particular good, but for good itself. That let you know what is good, not I. As Professor C.S. Lewis rightly says, does that almighty God, all-knowing, omniscient God, needs to be told what you should or should not get? If on the one hand you say God is like that, and on the other hand you spend your time day in and day out pleading and saying, give this to me and do this to me and all that. So here, and the author goes on to say, therefore, that somewhere it's true that it helps people to live their life, managing stress and all that. But somewhere down the line, we have forgotten Jesus' message, which was the emphasis on other. All the time he said, love thy neighbor as thyself. Helping others, seeing them in their need. Where is the other gone in all this? This is coming, by the way, from a Christian author, a scholar, who is emphasizing and lamenting. And therefore, he ends up this article, we would like to read his very own words, where he says that the TV men, the politicians, the Christian interest groups, within quotes, says, they have invited us to subvert the Church of Jesus even as we celebrate it. With their help, we have made golden cows of ourselves, become a nation of terrified, self-obsessed idols. It works, and it may well keep working for a long time to come. When Americans hunger for selfless love and are fed only love of self, they will remain hungry. And too often, hungry people just come back for more of the same. So where is the selfless love which was taught by Jesus? And once again, that's exactly what Janina Gomes also says. She's talking about unconditioned love. The one who was on the cross still said, forgive them, Father, they know not what they are doing. Still have that love for those who persecuted and nailed him on the cross. She says, when the woman said, I can't love anymore, with my love I have given away all that I am. The tree replied, look at me, there are robins in my branches, owls in my trunk, moss and ladybirds in my bark. They may take what I have, but not what I am. This is the unconditioned love Jesus personified. Human relationships have come to mean manipulation and control. Let's hark back to the images of that first Christmas. They reflected love, awe, simplicity, humility and wonder. Where is that Christmas and the Christ? We'd just like to end by saying, therefore, that for doing that, let's go back. In fact, after reading that, this lecture becomes unnecessary. It's so beautifully, the words are so beautiful and touching of Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus just tells that to his disciples, that if you would just not only hear them, but also put them into practice, you will be like a wise man who built his home on a rock, so that when the wind came, when the storm came, when the floods came, the house was not disturbed in any way. So if you make a secure foundation of practicing these, whatever is given in the Sermon on the Mount, the injunctions of Jesus, then it will become a secure foundation on which you can build your spiritual life. What says Voice of the Silence? That you make for yourself an island of pure thoughts which nothing can disturb. The great world Maya's ocean, the waves of which, in terms of temptation, in terms of doubt, in terms of persecution and pain and affliction, can come and go. But if you have created in the that center of consciousness, of pure thoughts, through what Jesus has given, by living whatever he has said, then nothing can disturb you in this world. We would stop with this, and there are 5 minutes still there for asking questions. You heard the long question. That one thing is about how during the World War I, two nations are fighting, both are, by the way, and both of them are praying to the God and saying that let my nation win. Is it not petitionary prayer? What about the adultery talked about, that even looking at a woman in lust is actually having committed adultery? And then now look at what is happening now. You see that a man sees another woman and comes back to his wife, and the wife doesn't want to have that relationship, the physical intercourse with her, and they bash up each other. And then also you see how the models, they sell themselves, their bodies for money and all that. What is all that? Definitely it is a further degradation of what Jesus Christ is mentioning here. Of course, the very first part we will tackle first, and that is about petitionary prayer. That very instance has been given in the Key to Theosophy by HPB, where she talks about that what kind of prayer is this. Both of the nations are praying to the same God. Now, who is the God going to listen to? Is he going to listen to this first nation, or is he going to listen to the second nation? What is he going to do? He's going to be in dilemma if such a prayer is really answered by God. So, this our petitionary prayer, there is no doubt about that. And she is actually saying that such petitionary prayers need not be indulged into. That these prayers, as Mr. Judge points out, let us leave aside the question of the nations, even about the individuals, even about something as good as getting money for an orphanage, as Mr. Judge gives the example in the notes on the Bhagavad Gita, where he says that people pray and pray and pray that let somebody give money for this orphanage. And then what happens? Is it really that the God has answered this prayer? It's when it is said with true heart, with sincere heart, it is that heart's desire or thought which touches another sensitive and receptive heart, and that man, wherever he is moved to do that charity. As Mr. Judge says in letters that have helped me, that your desire, when it is sincere, it will strike like a Vulcan, and another man will do what you wanted to be the doer of. So it is this way that the prayer works. It is not as if some God is sitting just ready to listen to what you say and grant you your prayer. So those prayers, and as he says that then when there is a thunderstorm, when there is earthquake, people pray and pray and pray. But what happens? The earthquake continues, the thunderstorm continues, the famine continues, and you feel the prayers are not answered. And many, many prayers are not answered. Against that, if one or two are answered, people think that it's the prayer which has done it, whereas it's the very heart which went out, and those thoughts have really helped. So petitionary prayer, as she says, that prayer actually kills self-reliance. We are not supposed to indulge into that kind of a petitionary prayer. As for the other part of it, it is true. In fact, that is what Jesus is saying. In fact, he is setting up such a high standard, but we have fallen down so completely. He is setting up the standard that not actually committing adultery, that is bad in itself. But what he is trying to say is that even in thought, if you look at lust, look with lustful eyes at another woman, that is like committing adultery. Because from that thought, the step towards the action, there is a very short distance. You don't know when you will lose your control. If you have been entertaining that thought in your mind again and again, the actual commission of the action is going to be very, very easy. So it is not that. On the other hand, it could be that some person can commit that act and forget all about it. Maybe it's just one time that he does it. Whereas as compared to that, the other man...